Thank you for choosing this ABC Radio National podcast. When it's finished, we'll have details on other enlightening and entertaining programs that you may be interested in. But right now, here's your podcast.
Good evening, Robin Williams with In Conversation, and this time one of our brightest younger scientists, Brian Gaensler, professor at the University of Sydney, Federation Fellow, and a former professor at Harvard, no less, who's chosen to come back home. Well, let's get on with it right away. How long have you been back?
I moved back from the US about two and a half years ago.
Was it a shock?
It was a shock to realise how good scientists are in Australia, not because I didn't think they were good, but because I had been away for a long time, and the US mentality is Americans can do everything well and the rest of the world is a bit of a backwater. So it was a real pleasant surprise to rediscover just how high quality the people and the facilities were in Australia.
Even though you're comparing Sydney with MIT and Harvard?
Well, that was the big issue in moving back to Australia, is that I was at Harvard, which is ranked number one university in the world, and I was worried that if I left, every few days I would get frustrated and think, this wouldn't happen at Harvard, or people at Harvard don't have this difficulty. And I'm happy to say that I basically never find myself thinking that. While we can't compete with the scale and scope of these multi-billion dollar organizations, in terms of the quality of the work and of the people, I haven't really noticed any difference. And if anything, I'm able to do more here than I could in the US, because in the US, funding for science is in a pretty bad way, where here in Australia, science and astronomy in particular have a lot of government support.
Isn't that interesting? Now, Ken McCracken in this time slot said almost exactly the same thing, but he was describing life of something like 35 or 40 years ago. Now, he was talking about being a very self-reliant person who grew up in Tasmania and then was running a small show in Papua New Guinea. Now, his autobiography, Blast Off, is about rocket science and being involved in the beginnings of the space race. And he found that when he went actually to MIT, same place as you, well, Boston, he discovered that there were lots of people around who knew plenty of theory, but when it came to being practical and innovative, they were kind of stranded. Did you find similar sorts of things?
So I have crossed paths with Ken and we had exchanged such observations. I think that is the case. To turn it around, if places like MIT can make a criticism about the Australian students and staff that they hire, they say they're very good with their hands, but they don't understand the underlying theory. And I really felt that when I came there. I was very technically competent and I knew lots of techniques. But if you ask me the details of what was actually going on in the star or galaxy, there were students who could write down all the equations and I really didn't know. So there was a pretty steep learning curve. But I think the experience of having got a university degree in Australia and then spent almost 10 years in the US has now given me both sides of things. And I really try and make sure that my own students here in Australia don't have the sort of gaps in their knowledge that many Australians pick up.
Did you grow up in Sydney yourself?
Yeah, I grew up on the Northern Beaches.
When did you first become absorbed by the stars and the celestial work?
My earliest memories from the age of about, say, three was of being very excited by astronomy and of wanting to be an astronomer. I have one of those caricatures that gets done at the flea market or at a fair when I was very young, and the cartoonist had asked me what I wanted to be drawn as, and I had said an astronomer. And so I have this picture of myself at the age of about three or four looking through a telescope. So I don't actually remember ever wanting to do anything else. It was just a fascination from day one.
No idea where it came from.
When you grow up as a young kid, you start to accumulate this mentality that your parents or your teacher know all the answers. That if you don't know something, you ask mum or dad and they tell you.
And they're always right.
And they're always right. And somehow I stumbled across the fact that in astronomy, even more so 25, 30 years ago compared to now, there were a huge number of things we didn't know. And the idea that there are things that nobody knows, that like even mum and dad don't know the answer, and that there's no one in the world that does, that really excited me. And still today, the thrill of asking the world expert a particular question I've always wanted to know, and they say, we have no clue. I think that's really exciting. It means we're never going to run out of things to do, but it also really captures what science is all about, wanting to understand. And I think in a lot of other avenues of science, we understand the basics and we're now trying to fossick around in the details. But in astronomy, we don't even know what most of the universe is made of. So it's a huge thrill. It's a bit like being an explorer wanting to know what's off the edge of the map.
It's virtually the oldest science, isn't it? And if you go to the beginnings of modern science, Galileo, etc., it was really there from the start, and the idea that people still don't know what's going on in the heavens is somewhat startling.
We've come an enormous way. To have told Galileo that we would be able to know what stars are made of and how long they live for and how they're born and how they die. We know incredible amounts about things that we've never done anything towards except look at them. But the amazing thing about the universe is you can know enough to fill whole warehouses full of books and still have fundamental unsolved problems. I think there are lots of other areas of science like that. For example, studying the brain is probably a similar one. I actually have a continuing argument with a friend who's a neurologist over whether the brain or the universe is more complicated. But I think that the most appealing parts of science are the ones where, even though we've come so far, we've barely scratched the surface.
Well, of course, they do say, I think Susan Greenfield likes to talk about this. She's from Oxford, professor of pharmacology and a brain scientist. She often says that if you look at the number of connections between parts of the brain, it is more than the number of atoms in the universe. Squillions beyond belief, virtually infinity. Now, what about your own school career? Did you glide through without effort?
I think I have to say, in hindsight, I did. My own belief is that successful people are those who are either smart or work hard. And I started off by being smart and just breezing through and doing the minimum amount of effort. And then, against my own wishes, my parents transferred me to opportunity class in fifth and sixth grade. And I discovered that it wasn't enough to be smart because there were lots of other smart kids and that you had to work hard as well. And I think that work ethic is perhaps what's carried me to all the successes I've been lucky enough to have, is that there are lots of smart kids out there, but you have to figure out at some point that you have to apply yourself and that the answers don't always just come in a snap, no matter how clever you are.
Talking about successes, were you Young Australian of the Year?
It gets more and more embarrassing every year that goes on, but I was in 1999, so almost 10 years ago, yeah.
Young Australian of the Year. Well, why does it get more embarrassing?
Well, it's because I'm not young anymore.
Comparative, mate. For me, you're young. But when you made a speech, I think it was that speech, when you talked about your grandmother, remind us of that story.
That was actually a couple of years later. It was the Australia Day address, and I was asked to give a talk on Australia Day about the things that were important to me about Australia. And I felt very strongly, and particularly at the time, that the concept that Australia is a country of immigrants was what really defines us. At the time, this was in beginning of 2001, there was all sorts of issues going on with boat people and detention camps and all of that. And so I felt very passionate and emotional about this issue because I'm a first-generation Australian. My grandparents came here. They arrived from Germany in 1939, just escaping the Holocaust. And so to think what would have happened to them if they had been turned away by the Navy or put in a detention camp, I wouldn't be here. So if I'm considered a contributing, valued member of Australian society, then what better argument can we give for welcoming immigrants in the expectation that their children and grandchildren will also be proud, enthusiastic, contributing Australians?
Jewish family?
Yeah, Jewish family in Vienna and Berlin, and got out just in time.
Amazing. What about your grandmother?
Well, she passed away about 5 years ago or so, but she was really an amazing woman. She was very intelligent, had a veterinary degree and was practicing vet science in Germany, but basically got on the first boat she could out of Germany, didn't really know where she was going, ended up in Australia, didn't speak any English, and wasn't allowed to practice her veterinarian program because the qualifications weren't recognized. So she had to really start again. She learned English, got several more degrees, and was working on a PhD when she passed away, and was really just full of energy and very involved in the community and just loved learning. And I think she passed that love of learning onto her sons and then onto her grandchildren.
Isn't it important how much a culture of learning makes a difference in a family? It really, having those sort of role models. Practically every interview I've done with a younger person, and for the sake of argument, I'll include you, is there is a teacher, there is a parent, there is some sibling, and being able to follow that example is vastly important, isn't it?
Well, it is a bit of a stereotype about the Jewish mother who wants her son to be the lawyer or the doctor, but there is a fair bit of truth in that stereotype, and that Jewish families value education very, very highly, and on both sides of my family came here without really much money, and the other side of my family, no one had even gone to university, but I was very strongly encouraged that if you want to get anywhere, you need to go to university and get a degree, and that will just open so many doors for you, and that advice and pressure proves spot on.
Now, you talked about the beginnings and ends of parts of the universe. Tell me about this exploding star that you've been working on most recently. It's quite a young one, isn't it? In fact, what you'd call a supernova, one that used to be a star but blew up and turned into something else.
So this is an object whose name, very catchy, is G350.1-0.3, which essentially gives you its coordinates.
Like poetry, really.
It is. We're trying to come up with a catchy name for it. It looks a bit like a canon, and one of the staff I have working on it is an Arsenal fan, so she insists that it's the canon. So we know that big stars, when they reach the end of their lives, they explode catastrophically in this huge detonation called the supernova. And for one moment, that star is giving off more light than the entire half a trillion stars in the galaxy combined. So it's a pretty catastrophic event. And we know from looking at other galaxies, not the Milky Way, but looking at whole other galaxies, that this happens about once every 50 years. But most people listening will think, well, that's funny. I'm 50-something and I don't seem to remember a star exploding. If this does happen, and it happens near us, these explosions can be so bright that you can see them in broad daylight and you can read by them at night. So when they happen, you know about them. We know that this actually happens because we have fantastic records from the Chinese going back thousands of years reporting when such an event happened. And they didn't know they were exploding stars. They thought there was some sort of warning and normally 1,000 peasants would be executed or something. But certainly we have good records of when and where these things happened. And we know that there hasn't been a supernova that we've seen in our galaxy since the year 1604. And Sod's law has it that the telescope was invented in 1608. So we haven't had a supernova since the invention of the telescope. Even the law of averages says we should have one every 50 years. So either our galaxy is very unlucky or very weird, or we're just not seeing them. We're not looking in the right place, or they're hidden. So there's a bit of a push to find all these supernova explosions that might have happened in the last few hundred years, but which somehow we miss. And the presumption is that we know of lots of smoke rings or debris of supernovae. The presumption is not that we've somehow looked at ones that we thought were old and haven't realized they're actually quite young. More likely explanation is that we've completely missed the young ones. And so as a bit of a detective hunt, I guess that maybe these young ones, some of them were staring us in the face and we had somehow overlooked them, a bit like, you know, losing your keys and not realizing they're on the desk in front of you. So what we did is we basically looked through the galaxy for objects that were very bright, but which had been classed as oddballs or had been forgotten about. And we discovered this object, G350.1-0.3, that was discovered in the early 70s here in Australia and was immediately classed as the remnant of a supernova explosion. But back in the 1970s, they didn't have the quality of instruments that they could tell whether it was a young one or an old one. So it just sat there in the catalogue as one of many random remnants of supernova explosions. In the mid-80s, somebody decided to have a closer look at it. And when they made a pretty picture of it, they saw this very strange appearance. It was very distorted and elongated. It didn't look like an expanding bubble. And they said, we have no idea what this is, but it sure ain't a supernova remnant. And then the group that keeps the official catalogue of supernova remnants saw this claim and said, well, okay, we'll take it out of our catalogue. And then everyone else who came along later who never saw that original paper never even knew that this object existed. So you drop something out of the catalogue and it just essentially disappears from view. And so we found this weird bright object and we looked up in the catalogue and I said, well, let's just check some older catalogues. And I went back to catalogues in the 80s and it said it was a supernova remnant. And I said, hang on, and eventually figured out what had happened. And so we said, well, that doesn't seem so obvious to us. Let's have a closer look at it. And when we looked at it with a new European X-ray satellite called XMM, we discovered that it was a very strange-looking object, but it is a supernova remnant. And not only that, it's one of the youngest supernova remnants in our galaxy.
It's only about 1,000 years old, isn't it?
Only about 1,000 years old. So it would have actually happened during the Middle Ages, and if you'd been looking in the right spot, you might have seen something. So right under our noses, this is one of those 20 or so supernova explosions that have happened in the last 1,000 years that we completely missed. This is one of the brightest, most energetic supernova explosions in the entire galaxy. The X-rays are filled with the radioactive decay of all the new, fresh elements that were made in the explosion. We actually know for a fact that all the elements in the universe heavier than iron were made in supernova explosions. It's the only place hot enough and extreme enough to make them. So many of the heavier elements in our bodies were actually made in supernova explosions. And here we are, we're actually seeing the radioactive decay of those elements that are fresh out of the oven. They're only made 1,000 years ago. Unlike hydrogen and helium, which have been around for billions of years, these are brand new elements now cooling, and we can directly see that in this spectacular young object.
It's a wonderful way to put it, fresh out of the oven. Now, I've got the strangest kind of picture, and this may be terribly simplistic, of the way a star, like the Sun, can gradually burn itself out and kind of collapse in on itself, become terribly dense, and there's a limit to the amount of density you can endure, and then it explodes. Is it something like that?
That does happen, but it happens after the supernova explosion. The first thing to say is that the sun is too small to make a supernova. You need a star that weighs about 8 times the mass of the sun for this to happen. The interior of the star is so hot and so dense that the hydrogen actually fuses to form helium, the same fusion reaction that happens in a hydrogen bomb. And then most of the star's life is spent converting hydrogen to helium. That's what the sun is doing right now. But if the pressures are high enough, then once all the hydrogen is used up and has become helium, the star will start collapsing again, and then it will begin turning hydrogen into carbon. And then that carbon can then be turned into oxygen. And you have this whole stepladder process where each element gets turned into heavier and heavier elements. And that ends when the entire core of the star has fused into iron. And it doesn't matter how hard you squeeze iron, it's the most stable element that exists, and it will not fuse into anything heavier. So you have this iron core that starts off as a tiny little nugget at the center of the star, and then just grows gradually as all the other elements fuse into iron. And when you hit this magic number of about 1.4 times the mass of the sun, you have a ball of iron that's so heavy that the individual atoms can no longer support the weight of its gravity. And catastrophically, that ball of iron suddenly collapses to something that's only about 25 kilometers across, made completely of neutrons. So all of a sudden, you have this huge, massive star, millions of kilometers across, that was being held up by this iron at the center, and now that iron ball has essentially shrunk to something 100 times smaller. So you've got this big hole in the middle, and the outer layers of the star fall down, smash into this rock-hard neutron star, rebound, and that's what blows the star up.
Down to something the size of Wollongong.
Pretty much, yeah. They've got something that weighs 1.4 times the mass of the sun. That's many trillions, trillions, trillions of kilograms, but compressed into the size of a small city. So you have a neutron star, which is regarded as the densest substance in the universe. A teaspoon of a neutron star would weigh about the same as 10,000 Sydney Harbour Bridges. So most of matter is actually empty. Matter is that you and I are made of is a small nucleus of protons and neutrons, and then a vast amount of empty space and these electrons around the outside. And a neutron star is basically the same stuff, but you've gotten rid of all that empty space around each nucleus and packed the atomic nuclei together. And so if you do that, you get a very different type of matter that has no empty space and is much, much smaller and denser.
Well, now you've got this young beast only 1,000 years old. Are you able to watch it change, or does even something like that so young move slowly?
We can watch it change. The discovery observation that we made was with this European satellite XMM, which doesn't have particularly sharp vision, but which is useful because it's good at seeing very faint objects. So the next step is to observe it with an American X-ray satellite called Chandra. And Chandra isn't as sensitive as XMM, but it has incredibly sharp vision, the sharpest vision that's ever been available in X-rays. And so in the next few months, later this year or early next year, we're observing the source for an entire day with Chandra, and that will give a spectacularly sharp view of the remnant, showing all the fine filaments and wisps, and that will be the first observation that we can then use maybe 3 or 4 years from now to come back and watch it expand. So certainly, yes, we do expect to be able to watch this object expand slowly over a period of a few years, and that will give us a more exact age for it.
Just so happens that Chandra, which is in Harvard, is run by an Australian, Roger Brissenden. Is that right?
That's right. Roger is flight manager or whatever for Chandra. He's from Adelaide, and every week I get his email update assuring us that Chandra is performing well and there have been no glitches. He really was one of the people instrumental in making this incredibly complicated mission fly. And his no-bull attitude that Australians tend to have is, I think, very refreshing for the scientists working on Chandra.
Indeed. Just to give a home association, his cousin, I think, is Michael Brissenden from the 7:30 report.
I actually wondered if there was any relation there.
Yeah. Yes, that's what he told me. So you still maintain this working link with Boston and, in this case, Chandra.
I think one of the real advantages of letting us Australians have this brain drain but then making sure they come back is they bring back all this experience and connections with them. So I still have students that I left behind with me at Harvard and staff. I have a huge number of collaborators. I just had visit me 2 weeks ago the scientist who built one of the main cameras for Chandra visiting us here in Australia and was able to meet with my students. So that connections of having these absolutely top-notch people who essentially are available at any time, I can call them up and ask them questions or ask them to come over, is a huge advantage for me and for my students and for all astronomers here. Because what we do here, we do well, but we just have such tiny numbers that it's hard to get critical mass in certain areas. But now with myself and other Australians who have been coming back, we can piggyback on the much bigger endeavours that are going on in other countries.
Now, you said that the funding for astronomy is pretty good, and that, I think, is a fair enough statement to make. The commitment, for instance, to the array, which is, we hope, going to be set up in Western Australia. That's a major, major project, and it's down to the last one or two possible countries which might be involved, millions of dollars. So that sort of thing should not be discounted, because astronomy is a very expensive pursuit. What do you think, however, in general, about Australia's commitment to science and the funding that goes on, not just in state levels, but federally?
I think that things are not that great at the moment. We just had announcement of annual grants from the Australian Research Council, and only about 1 in 5 grants across the board are being funded, which in itself is not great, but not a disaster. But of those 1 in 5, they would then only get half the money they were asking for. So not every person who asks for money should be getting it, but Australia is at the moment only funding about 1/10 of what the community are asking for. And as a benchmark, most other countries, it's more like 1/4 or 1/3. So I would say that overall, people are struggling. There is a raft of new programs that the new government have brought in as part of their election promises. They've got 1,000 of these future fellowships and these other programs called laureate fellowships. So those, on the one hand, will create more jobs and help more good people get jobs in Australia. On the other hand, it will create more hungry mouths who will then want to be fed with grants. So we'll have to see how that changes the playing field. I would say at the moment the funding system is not that generous. If you're in astronomy, things are pretty good. But if you're in some other field, I think it is a real battle, and only the very, very best people are able to get grants. And there's a host of excellent work being done beneath that very top tier that perhaps isn't being funded in the way it should.
There is, in fact, a new green paper published by the minister, Kim Carr. And I think that reflects something that Vicky Sara, who's the Chancellor of UTS, University of Technology in Sydney, who used to be involved with the Research Council, has demanded, and that is at least a doubling of the ARC Research Council commitment, and that's from $1 billion to $2 billion, at least. So instead of 1 in 5, it'll be 2 in 5.
That particular paper does have some excellent recommendations. So it would be 2 in 5 at half the level they need, or 1 in 5 at the full level. The other issue is that even if you get everything you ask for, the Australian Research Council policy is that, well, not its policy, but the government prevents it from funding the full cost of research. So I can get money for my travel or for my equipment, but I can't get any money to pay for me or for my room or my desk or my electricity or my air conditioning. So the other problem is that even if you get everything you ask for, the universities have to cover just as much money again to just keep the people who said they would do the research in business. So another recommendation in that report that would be quite expensive but is really critical is that the Australian Research Council and other government organisations need to start paying for the full cost of research. They pay for the stuff that's obvious, but all the hidden costs they're not paying for, and that's a massive drain on the universities.
Now, I had something in the Science Show the other week. Michio Kaku, another physicist from New York, actually, City University, he talked about young people asking, what's science got to do with me? Well, how does it affect me personally? His answer was, everything, every part of your life is affected by science. Do you sometimes have those sorts of arguments with young people about, you know, obviously outside the university, about why the bloody hell should we give our tax dollars to you scientists to have fun?
I actually run into that conversation a lot, and I even have it with other scientists. Scientists who are working on things like finding cures for cancer make comments about astronomy. My in-laws, none of whom will be listening to the show because they're all in the US, some of them are creationists and pretty fundamentalists, so they wonder what the point is of spending money on this. So I get that question an awful lot, and I think it's critical that every scientist has good, robust, convincing answers as to why a country like Australia should be spending money on basic research when we have all sorts of other issues like education and climate change that we need to be worrying about also.
Just to prove that our program is heard in the United States, would those people listening there please send emails to Brian Gaines at the University of Sydney? And what's your email address?
I'd be happy to receive any emails. bgainsler@ucid.edu.au.
Yes, that's G-A-E, Gainsler.
So, thanks, Robin.
So, were you serious about creationists?
My uncle, or my wife's uncle, works as a security guard at the Creation Museum in Cincinnati. My wife visited the museum for me and brought back a really amazing book about astronomy, written by an astronomer with a PhD from a respectable university who is a creationist and has some very compelling arguments, very clever arguments as to why the universe is only 6,000 years old in the light of current astronomical evidence. He doesn't sweep anything under the carpet. If I wasn't a professional astronomer, I would be utterly convinced by this book. You have to read it very carefully and think very hard to figure out the holes in his argument.
takes all types, doesn't it? Professor Brian Gainsler is Professor and Federation Fellow at the University of Sydney. Next week, a type who's hard to categorise, Nick Drayson, biologist, Darwinian, and a novelist with a guide to the birds of East Africa, Not What It Seems. I'm Robin Williams.
Let me say at the outset, it is not a pretty picture.
In his next Boyer lecture, Rupert Murdoch buys into the schools debate.
As a rule, we spend too much time on avoiding failure. The real answer is to start pursuing success.
And he's calling for urgent reform.
No government of any decent society should be effectively writing off whole segments of the population by refusing to confront a failing education bureaucracy.
And you can download the Boyers from the Radio National website.